Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Money and Markets with John Titus and Catherine Austin Fitz. The world is evolving and changing rapidly as we speak. We're recording on Wednesday, October 2nd for publication on October 3rd. John, what's our theme?
The theme is cash and the Constitution. And like you said, it may not be the happiest Saleri report. It might be the most action-packed, though. Yes. I feel like I'm back at the track with a friend of mine and be like, there's too much action. There's too much action.
It's like an amazing, you know, A-team action film. The reason our theme is cash and the Constitution is we have many powerful weapons that we have not even begun to use. And one of them is cash. Anything we can do to stop the all-digital system from rolling in, we need to do. But what we're watching in the disaster zones all around the world and all around the United States is everybody is reminded of why they need cash. We are getting reports from everywhere that stores can only take cash. The electricity is down. And people are saying, Oh, now I know why all the preppers say you ought to have cash. So cash is a powerful weapon. The Constitution is our most powerful weapon. And as I travel the country, we've only yet just started to use it as people realize we're just going to have to get out of the political theater and into taking action. So more as we go through, but let's just dive
in. The onslaught of attacks on the Constitution going on right now is no accident. And we'll touch on that in one of our stories today.
It's unbelievable. Right.
Let's start FedWatch with the hurricane in the mountains of North Carolina and Tennessee, odd place for a hurricane. And we'll go to a story from Knox News out west there from Knoxville. Ingles credit card processing damaged by Hurricane Helene. Stores taking cash and checks. Ingles Market, based in flood-ravaged western North Carolina, is grappling with damage to its credit card processing capabilities that has cascaded to its grocery stores throughout the region, including East Tennessee. The stores are accepting cash and checks, but not credit and debit cards. They're hoping to be able to take cards again by midweek. That's not really reassuring. They're hoping when you can't get food.
Right. So it's interesting. All the reports I have from Saleri Report subscribers in East Tennessee and North Carolina, being Saleri Report subscribers, they have cash. And they're talking about how they're lending and giving cash to neighbors and friends and family because a lot of people don't realize why you need cash.
Yeah. Right. Well, we saw that last week with the story out of China.
Right.
Remember the power goes out? You see this guy with the generator set up and there's like hundreds of people online to get their phone charged.
Because that's where their money is. They can't get their money without their phone.
Yeah. Right. That's the same reason you have books. You don't need to boot the thing up. You just read it.
Right.
You need light. But let's go back to the mountains, go back to the hurricane. This next story kind of adds some financial color to it from the Watauga Democrat. I think that's a county out there. Biden approves major disaster declaration for North Carolina, including Watauga County. This is FEMA. Uh-oh, Darth Vader appears immediately in the story. FEMA has announced that federal disaster assistance is available. Look at this list of counties, okay? These are all counties. Alexander, Allegheny, all the way down to Transylvania, Watauga, Wilkes, and Yancey. 25 counties. So it's grants for temporary housing and home repairs, low-cost loans for uninsured property. And this is for individuals and business owners to recover from the effects of the disaster. Separate and apart from that, federal funding is also available to state, tribal, and eligible local governments, and certain private nonprofits. The 25 counties, by the way, also extends to the eastern band of Cherokee Indians. So there's a lot of, I should point out one other thing in this story. Speaking of Darth Vader, Thomas J. McCool has been named the federal coordinating officer for federal recovery operations. Do you remember that name? Sure you do.
It was the FEMA administrator, who's a woman, who was prominent in Lahaina, who's also prominent here as well. He's the immediate,
These are repeat characters.
Right. Yeah. This is repeat. There are so many examples of the same fact patterns we saw in Katrina. The thing I'm most suspicious of, and I will admit this is conjecture, is my guess is the White House, because I saw this when I was HUD. I saw when you had a disaster, a lot of rules go out the window and you have enormous flexibility to pour in money and pour in things with the federal credit that normally you could never do. It's quite remarkable when it happens because it's like somebody blows a whistle and all the rules are gone. But my guess is the White House is negotiating dramatically with governors and states disaster recovery money in exchange for playing ball on the election. So, you know, my big question is, you know, clearly this is some kind of disaster capitalism, but is this also election fraud? Are we watching more election fraud?
Yeah, it also recalls the pandemic when right. You have the Paycheck Protection Program, the money faucet goes on. Supposedly it was low cost loans. Those loans ended up being, canceled, and they turned into basically outright gifts.
Right.
So the money spigot is on here. There's no doubt about that. And that list of counties, that's incredible.
It's on big time.
But that list of counties, there's 100 counties in North Carolina. 25 of them are in that story. This is a major, major disaster.
The reports we're getting, and I just want to encourage everybody, if you have reliable, if you're in the area, send us reports. If you have reliable people in your network who are sending you reports, please post them. The best intelligence we're getting is from individuals on the ground, and we want to keep getting that. But this looks like the damage is extraordinary.
It does. From the videos, you can see that. And there's there's thousands of videos. I watched probably 100 of them, and they're unbelievable. Bridges going out, houses being washed away, people being stranded. But you're exactly right. It's the anecdotal stories it's the devil's in the details.
Right.
You know, about rescues being prevented and the involvement of federal officials and state officials. Like, what's really going on with this?
Something stinks. And we'll get to the Tennessee National Guard story, but something stinks.
That's another interesting story. There's a ton of interesting stories this week, I gotta tell you. But let's get back on theme on cash and the Constitution. With the latter part of the theme, the Constitution, and an article from Jonathan Turley, The Counterconstitutional Movement, The Assault on America's Defining Principles. This went into the Wall Street Journal. I believe the headline was The Left's Attack on the Constitution. This is the same piece. But he begins basically with Kamala Harris. She said they were open to the idea of packing the court by expanding the number of seats. Biden opposed the idea, but a week after he exited the presidential campaign, he announced a bold plan to reform the high court, and he too would pack the court via term limits and also impose a binding code of conduct aimed at conservative justice. Turley says there's a growing counter-constitutional movement, growing attack on the Constitution that began in higher education and in media and politics. He cites the New York Times book critic, Jennifer Salai, and she scoffs at what she calls constitutional worship. She frets that by limiting the power of the majority, the Constitution can end up fostering widespread cynicism that helps authoritarianism grow. Just an excuse to attack the Constitution. Barbara McQuaid of University of Michigan Law School has called free speech America's Achilles heel. The Nation gets in on the action. Eli Messel calls the Constitution trash and urges the abolition of the U.S. Senate. Rosa Brooks of Georgetown Law School complains that Americans are slaves to the Constitution, and on and on and on. Turley says the cry for radical constitutional change is short-sighted. The system was designed for bad times, not only good times. It seeks to protect individual rights, minority factions, and smaller states from the tyranny of the majority. But the attack is on.
So here's the thing. The central bankers want to use an all-digital system to basically assert control of fiscal policy as well as monetary policy. Very simple. It's a big change in governance. The Constitution is in the way. And one of the biggest reasons the Constitution is in the way is the powers of the federal government on fiscal and monetary are delegated by the states to the federal government. The states are superior under the Constitution. And many of the powers, all the powers not delegated to the feds, are reserved to the states. And that is a big problem for the central bankers. And so if you look between a constitutional convention or different proposals or for amendments, or most of all, using central bank printed money to sort of, or created money to buy everyone out of obeying the Constitution at the state level or pushing back at the state level, you know, those tricks are wearing thin. And the day is coming when you have a real constitutional confrontation. And of course, one of the things they'd love is to have a weakened Supreme Court when that happens. So
that would help. I think, you know, the bigger problem, I mean, I disagree with you on what their hurdle is with the Constitution. It's not the states. That's not the problem. The problem the feds and the central bankers have with the U.S. Constitution is that there's only three branches of government. So there's the legislature, there's the presidency, there's the courts. That's it. And so the Federal Reserve and central banks, you know, all these administrative agencies, they're creatures of Congress. They always answer to Congress, right. And thus there's always transparency built in. And central bankers hate transparency. They can't operate in the dark in the U.S. They can operate in the dark in Russia. They can operate in the dark in throughout all of Europe. It's illegal in Europe for the legislature, for parliament, to get involved with the central bank at all. In the U.S., it's the law that they get involved.
Right. Although if you look at what they've done with the violations of the financial management law and with FASB 56, they've taken things remarkably dark. They're in massive violation of the financial management laws, both the monetary laws and the fiscal laws.
Right. But a lot of that, though, Catherine, is Congress has the power to get into the Fed and to get into have transparency. But they got to have what you said at the top of the show. People have to get angry and behind Congress and put the pressure on Congress. Once the pressure goes on, the spotlight goes on in the and we get sunshine.
So you're absolutely right about transparency, but let me ask you another question. Pallas said he needs authorizing legislation to do CBDCs.
Yes.
Is it easier for them to just bust the Constitution so that they can do CBDCs without authorizing legislation?
They wouldn't dare under the currently configured legal system.
Right.
Jerome Powell and the Fed would not dare to issue a CBDC. They need a fourth branch of government.
Right. This is the central bankers versus the Constitution.
Absolutely.
Right. There we go.
But their number one friend under the currently configured system is public apathy.
Correct.
Everything's okay. Just sit there. All you got to do is bark at your television and you'll be fine.
So in the last couple of weeks, I've met with a remarkable number of legislators or people who work with the legislature in multiple states, as well as bankers. And you would be absolutely shocked at the extent to which no one has warned them that this train is headed right for them and they're about to be replaced. They don't know. And I have this elevator pitch. We have a commentary called the Threat of Financial Transaction Control. And I show them 3 1-minute videos, you know, Carstens, Boley, and Cash Carry. Boom, boom, boom. It only takes 5 minutes to show these 3 1-minute videos and explain, you know, what they say. And after the end of 5 minutes, their mouth is on the floor. They had no idea.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, pick out 10 people, particularly your bankers, and educate them. They need to know this is coming. They need to know to push back now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. There was a lot of pushback during the global financial crisis. We saw the power of Congress to get what they wanted in the way of transparency.
Right.
The sunlight was on. They turned that one up to high. But since then, there's been a lot of apathy. And one of the reasons for the apathy is the credit printing machine. It can buy people off and sedate people.
There's a tsunami of money buying everybody.
Yeah.
Almost everybody.
Yep.
Right.
Okay, let's keep it going in FedWatch with another disaster of potentially. This is the strike. U.S. port strike by 45,000 dock workers is all but certain to begin at midnight. Actually, it has begun, but I left the story in here anyway because it's the Associated Press and AP. So subscribers know AP is one of the big three news generating agencies. The AP, there's Reuters, and there's Agence France-Presse. Those are the big three in the world. So there's a lot of telegraphing going on in this article. Why I kept it in. So let me go back to it. Port strike. 45,000 members of the union, dock workers, walk off the job at midnight. The coming work stop threatens to significantly snarl the nation's supply chain, You've heard that term before, a lot, potentially leading to higher prices and delays for households if it drags on for weeks. That's because strike by members of the International Longshoremen's Association could cause 36 ports, which handle roughly half of the goods shipped into and out of the U.S., to shutter operations. So get ready. And then down here, they say if drawn out, the strike could interfere with Christmas, basically. Actually, if it's not drawn out, if it's a short strike,
right,
it can have ripples into Thanksgiving, basically.
Absolutely. So the interesting thing is, although this is portrayed as being about wages, it's really about automation. And one thing worth thinking about, it was funny, somebody tweeted out a little cartoon that said, most of the automation is manufactured in China.
Yeah, there's no doubt.
So we can pay Americans, or we can pay the Chinese to, you know, put the Americans out of work. So there's some interesting political questions here. But one question I have for you and for everybody listening is, do you want humans running and controlling the port, or do you want an automated port where Mr. Global can send in and out anything he wants without
a lot of human oversight and a lot of human involvement?
Right.
And if you make me choose between the two, the machines are gone.
Right. I'm with you. Not to say that there's not corruption in the humans that run ports. I mean, I grew up in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
So I've seen a lot, but you know, there is a human element that will not tolerate certain kinds of corruption, or will right. keep limits on it. And you automate it, and what you're going to see going in and out of the ports is going to terrify you.
To automate it fully means a complete lack of transparency and total darkness, and you don't want that.
Right. You do not want your ports going dark. Right.
No, absolutely not. Okay, let's keep it going in FedWatch with another story that's developing. This is a bad one, too, of concerning the national debt. Not really the debt per se. This is from Richard Verner. National debt explosion, the fiscal time bomb, and its implication. Everybody knows, I think, that a national debt has reached a new all-time high of $35 trillion. That's a big number. You can see that the accumulation of debt here is exponential. No doubt about that. But, you know, that's how it is. It's always kind of exponential.
Right.
But the real story here is this. Interest payments on debt now exceed $1 trillion ahead of military spending. That's the problem.
I think that's one of the reasons the Fed brought down the Fed funds rate.
Had to have been, yeah.
Right.
Because of this. Total revenues from taxes, Social Security contributions, and other sources, that amounts to $3.75 billion. Okay. The deficit interest payments, $1.045 trillion. Okay, so that's 21% more than one fifth of the total U.S. government expenditures so far this year. But the real number is this: the interest payments amount to 82% of the U.S. government budget deficit so far this year. So you've got a problem here where your interest payment of $1 trillion, if you let it keep going, it's gonna eventually, because it's an exponent, is going to overtake your revenue of $3.75 billion.
Right, but you're going to go into hyperinflation before that. I mean, the problem is to keep pumping out the money to pay everything. You're debasing the dollar rapidly.
You know what they'll do before they do that? They'll have the Fed buy the debt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the interest payment would be recycled back right. into the government. That's what they'll do. There's no doubt.
Right. You know, but that's, I keep coming back to the problem with the currency is it's debt-based.
Yes. The exponent is coming from the debt.
Right. It's a scam. Right. The whole thing's a scam.
Right.
You know, so we're in a debt trap, but we're in a debt trap because we got there through a scam. And one of the reasons the central bankers want to take over, you know, want to take control of the fiscal side of the house, is they don't want the scam to end, but they have to go to total control to keep it going.
Exactly. You right. got it. The scam, by the way, so subscribers, this started in 1694 with the Bank of England. And the scam is this: instead of England just issuing money, say, $1 billion back, £1 billion, okay, instead of having the crown issue 1 billion pounds, William Paterson, the head of the Bank of England back then, who used to be a pirate, by the way, said, you know what, instead of you issuing the money, why don't we do this? My private bank here, we'll issue the money and you can borrow the money from us at interest. And the crown agreed. What a great idea. Right. That's the scam right there. Like, instead of you issuing it, you will issue it and you borrow it from us.
Let me explain the economics of the scam. The economics of the scam is I issue bonds and my bonds pay for me to go to war. And in the war, I make more booty. And this is why pirates were so critical to the system. I get more booty than the cost, you know, that I finance with the bonds. So my booty comes in and I can pay back the bonds and I have a profit left over, right? That's why they call it the central banking warfare model. Right?
The central banking warfare model. That's it. And also, at the same time, you get wars, so you can gin up more money and more debt. You also have to institute taxes so you can pay the interest. Isn't that nice?
Right. So you've got to float the whole thing. But our problem is the booty on the wars, and we'll get into more booty in some of the later stories. Is our booty on the wars covering the amount of money we're borrowing to finance the wars?
Right.
The economics of the U.S. military machine has been designed to create billionaires and pump up the stock market. It's not an efficient military machine.
That is just, it's not efficient. Moreover, your model is good so long as you're winning the wars.
Right.
When you lose,
if you can't stop the Iranian missiles, you've got a big central banking warfare problem.
There's two ways to destroy a currency. One is to borrow a foreign currency, which we'll never do. There's not room for it. We already have 60% of the world's currency. There's no room to borrow 60%. You know, it's the majority. The other way to destroy a currency is to start losing wars.
Right.
We've chosen path number two.
Well, but here's the problem. If you can't get the booty in the foreign wars, you're going to have to get the booty domestically, which brings us back to what's going on in North Carolina.
You got it.
Right.
Yep. It's
connect the dots. Connect
the snake is eating its tail. You got it.
Yep. Here we go.
All right. So let's turn to space military global turf wars. And for my money, the most interesting story this week from the cradle. This is fascinating.
This guy did a great job. Thank you.
Why does the U.S. still control every penny of Iraqi oil revenue? Well, I don't know. Why don't you tell me? In July, the Iraqi central bank halted. This is July of this year. Halted all foreign transactions in yuan, succumbing to intense pressure from the U.S. Federal Reserve to do so. What? Why would they listen to the Fed? How has the U.S. managed to exert such total control over Iraqi financial policy? The answer lies in 2003 with mechanisms established following the illegal U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Since signing Executive Order 13303 by President George Bush in May of 2003, all revenues from Iraq's oil sales have been funneled directly into an account at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And ever since then, Bush signed that, every president every year has renewed it, including Joe Biden this year. Okay. According to international humanitarian law, this is the truly twisted part. This has American Fed written all over. According to the international humanitarian law, occupation forces, in this case the US and UK, become responsible for the well-being of the populations they occupy. So, United Nations Security Council Resolution 1483 was issued on May 22, 2003, to establish the US-led coalition provisional authority. CPA is Iraq's administrator. What happens? Well, it was a CPA led by Paul Bremer that decided unilaterally to house the account at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. From that point until today, the Iraqi Ministry of Finance has had to submit requests for funds to the U.S. Treasury, which then approves or denies these requests based on its own criteria. Did you know any of this?
Yeah. I knew we were commanding the oil. I didn't know the details of how they were doing it. And one of the big questions that Skidmore and I have had for years is of the 21 trillion in undocumentable adjustments, how much of that is war booty rolling back in?
You got to wonder.
Right.
I didn't. That comes as news to me. I didn't. But then again, I was asleep on the couch until 2008. Basically, so 5 years of that story was, you know.
Well, you don't think we land conquer these countries for rights of women, do you?
Yeah, no, right. I know it's not a humanitarian project. I get it. But the mechanism there is, it, you know, the appearance of the New York Fed in the story is what caught my eye. It's like, oh, of course it's the New York Fed.
Right.
It's the only Federal Reserve. It's the only Fed bank with a trading desk. That you know, when you talk about the Fed, you're talking about the New York Fed.
Right. So it's called a gross pledge. And, you know, when you issue bonds, the revenues have to roll in and the bondholders get to take the money first. So. This is, we've got a gross revenue pledge from Iraq.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's just, wow. What an interesting story. But let's keep it going in space, military, global turf wars and move to China. You know, we've shown charts where China's stock market has just been the dog.
It's on a tear because they've got a huge amount of subsidy rolling in.
Well, for most of this year, though, it's been beaten badly. But now it's turned around. And this next story is about that. This is, from a blog called Pekingology. Anyway, Beijing's dramatic week of econ policy intervention. What are they doing? On September 24 this year, during a press conference held by the State Council Information Office, the three major financial regulatory bodies made significant announcements. They also introduced various tools to support the stable development of the stock market. Notably, the governor of the central bank, People's Bank of China, announced an injection of 800 billion yuan. That's massive. That's about over $100 billion into the stock market through operations such as swap facilities between securities, fund, and insurance companies, as well as stock repurchase financing. This is the first time they've ever done this in China's history. Yeah, no kidding. Following this, on September 26th, the Politburo of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China convened a meeting with several unusual aspects that pushed the market enthusiasm to new heights, but they didn't need to because of this. They're going to pump that money in the stock market. That's just an astonishing intervention by what is traditionally a very conservative central bank.
Right, and understand in the China, the stock market is nowhere near as important to the general population as it is in the United States. So, you know, in Beijing, you're watching the price of pork much more than you're watching the stock market. So for them to intervene like this, you know, they had real concerns. And the thing that's tricky to watch about this, John, is one of my favorite quotes, you know, is from Jack Ma, when trade stops, war starts. If you look at the tensions globally between the United States and China, particularly given China's support of Russia in the last couple of years, the tensions are real. At the same time, the economic dependency of the U.S. and the G7 on China is extraordinary. And if China really craters economically, it pulls the whole world down.
Yes.
So it's like Siamese twins fighting. Really? Yes. No, that's exactly what it's like. That, you know, the
yeah.
We're completely dependent on China for everything. I mean, if we're going to automate the ports, it's coming from China, right?
Right. Yeah.
If we want antibiotics, they need to keep shipping the materials.
Right.
So, anyway.
Okay, let's keep it going. You know, I would say let's go to genocide in Gaza, but we can no longer have that heading because Israel has expanded the war fronts. It's no longer just Gaza. So we're just going to turn to Israel. Right. Which is the source of many headlines this week. So let's start with Lebanon, and we'll start with a map, okay? Just to keep it simple, here's a map, okay? Here's Beirut in Lebanon. This is Israel here, all right? And so you could basically, from Beirut to Tel Aviv, it's 130 miles, okay? And this first, this next story, we'll go to Lavrov, because he has, last week, there was an attack by Israel on Beirut, where they leveled some apartment buildings. I mean, it was basically like 9/11 over there. They just attacked civilian infrastructure. It's like, are you kidding me? What is going on here? And Lavrov comes out, which this is so significant, because a lot of times Russia is sort of, they're on the balance beam with Israel. They never really come out and condemn Israel. So I found this next clip with Lavrov kind of significant, but they'll lay off Israel until Israel's in the wrong corner with the U.S. And that's this clip with Lavrov. Listen to what he says here.
Достижение политических целей является бесчеловечная атака на Ливан путем превращения гражданских технологий в смертоносное оружие. Необходимо немедленно расследовать это преступление, но уже сейчас нельзя обойти молчанием многочисленные публикации в средствах массовой информации, в том числе в Европе и здесь, в Соединенных Штатах, которые свидетельствуют о той или иной вовлеченности, как минимум осведомленности Вашингтона в том, что касается подготовки этого теракта. Мы понимаем, что американцы всегда все отрицают и сделают все, чтобы замотать появившиеся факты, так же, как они это сделали в ответ на неопровержимые доказательства их причастности к терактам на газопроводах «Северный поток».
Wow. So Washington's certain involvement and probable awareness in the preparation of the attack.
So is he talking about the pager explosions or the missiles striking the civilian targets, or both?
The missiles.
Missiles. Okay.
I believe he's talking about the missiles. You bring up the pagers. One of the things that we don't have a story on it this week that has emerged is when we speculated that this had to have been done at the production level, we were exactly right.
Right.
On that speculation, because as it turns out, Israel had a company in place for decades, a false company for an eventual terrorist attack. That's where the pager attack came from. But ultimately we were exactly correct. It was at the production level. It wasn't that they got pagers and they meddled with them. They rolled off the line like that, ready to explode.
Okay. So one of the allegations is that the Tel Aviv Mossad headquarters got hit. Is that where the 8200 group is? That's a question.
I believe, yes, it's in Tel Aviv. I think you're exactly right about that.
Well, it'd be very interesting to see if one of those missiles hit the 8200 group who would supposedly have been involved in doing that.
A lot of we'll get to Iran's attack on Israel because they've dropped a lot of bombs and it landed. But let's keep it going with Israel, because the timing of this, okay, Israel invades Lebanon. Okay, so the Lavrov speech is after, there's so much action over there. Like I said at the top, so there's too much action to keep track of. So Israel, they blow up the exploding pagers, okay? Then Beirut explodes and the 9/11 in Beirut goes off.
Right.
Then they invade Lebanon, a ground invasion.
Right.
And then this story comes out of Tennessee. This is just one example of many, I'm sure. Tennessee National Guard Task Force deploying to Middle East. Okay, this is September 26th. More than 700 soldiers from the Tennessee Army National Guard's 278th are departing Saturday, September 28th. So they're already gone on the first leg of a year-long deployment to the Middle East. Guess where they're going? Our service members have spent the last year conducting rigorous training and preparing to deploy and support Operation Spartan Shield, said Lieutenant Colonel Jason Tomerlin, commander of the task force. Operation Spartan Shield builds partnerships in the Middle East, you can guess who, with, to promote regional self-reliance and increase security. So this, what Israel's doing over there is having an immediate domestic effect over here. Your troops are being deployed to support Israel. In war.
There are a couple of interesting things about this story. One is one of our heroes of the year was a representative in Tennessee who sponsored legislation saying no Tennessee Guard can go abroad unless there is a declaration of war by Congress. So, and that bill did not pass and get adopted. But it reflects the tremendous hostility towards the idea of Tennessee National Guard going to fight in wars that are covert or haven't been officially approved by Congress. Okay. So there's a lot of resistance to that happening. Now, this announcement came after...
Wait a minute. You mean 55 standing ovations of Netanyahu wasn't approval by Congress?
There's no official declaration of war by Congress.
Yeah, I know.
So the idea of, you know, basically drafting Americans to go fight in something where Congress hasn't... Well, right. You know what I mean. Anyway, so, but then this announcement comes after the hurricane, right? So yes. You have Eastern Tennessee experiencing tremendous damage. You don't send the National Guard in to help the local citizens, right? Which means somebody doesn't want aid going in.
Yeah.
I'll say that again. If you look at the speed at which the federal and state disaster recovery can go to work, that doesn't happen. And instead, the National Guard, instead of helping the people in East Tennessee, is shipping out to the Middle East.
Right. So Israel, they're done killing 186,000 people in Gaza. Now they've turned their attention to the north. They're moving into Lebanon. There's a hurricane in the U.S. and the National Guard is deployed to support who? Hurricane victims? No, to Israel.
So I would like to point out for the last, I think it's about 6 to 8 weeks, the official death count in Gaza has been 41,000 and hasn't changed. So just to point that out.
The Lancet said 186. I think that's light.
Right. I think it's light too.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's just keep it going with Israeli action. We now have financial action. Moody's. This is unbelievable. Moody's cuts Israel rating by 2 notches. The unexpectedly harsh downgrade driven by escalation in the north, meaning Lebanon, puts Israel on par with countries like Kazakhstan. They downgraded the country's rating by 2 notches from A2 to BAA1, which looks like ball, with a negative outlook. The key driver of the downgrade is our view that geopolitical risk has intensified significantly further to very high levels, with material negative consequences for Israel's creditworthiness in both the near and longer term. And they added, longer term, we consider that Israel's economy will be more durably weakened by the military conflict than expected earlier. And this is before, by the way, all this is going on before they get bombed by Iran. With heightened security risks, we no longer expect a swift and strong economic recovery as in previous conflicts. Yeah, no kidding.
So S&P followed Moody's a couple days later with a drop from A+ to A.
Yeah.
So still not in the BBB category. Moody's, you know, Moody's down to, so S&P only dropped a half a point. This is very noticeable because it is very rare in my experience to see a rating agency drop 2 at one time.
Yep.
It's kind of like, boom, what was that? And we have seen since the bailouts that ratings can be very politically sensitive. So when the S&P dropped the U.S. rating, and deservedly, the U.S. certainly deserved it, literally in 18 days, they get the president of S&P fired, and then the Department of Justice goes after the holding company and almost destroys them.
Wow.
Our history, and of course, we saw Moody's play ball during all the mortgage collateral fraud, et cetera. So for Moody's to do this means somebody's not stopping them from doing it.
Yes. Or it means Moody's is insane and they've just completely forgotten about what happened to S&P during the global financial crisis, which I don't think
they forgot. Right, but the U.S. is allowing this to happen. Because I know S&P only dropped a half, but, you know, they're smelling the winds of war and they move too. The U.S. is not stopping this.
Yes.
Right.
That's an interesting point. The U.S. isn't stopping it. And that brings us to the next major story of the week. This one broke last night, of Iran bombing Israel. And for some backstory, let's go to Moon of Alabama, because Bernard, the author of that blog, provides pretty much a timeline of the story. Iran, we had one yesterday. There's too much action. We had the story yesterday, but it's no longer viable. So we now have this story. Iran attacked Israel only after U.S. rejected its moderate stance. Yesterday, a massive barrage of Iranian ballistic missiles hit Israel. Here's the timeline. On May 20th, 2024, the then president of Iran, Ebrahim Raisi, died in a helicopter accident, okay, suspect. New elections were held, and to the astonishment of many, Pezeshkian, a moderate, won. His whole theme is, let's reconnect with the West. A lot of the country says, you're crazy. On July 30th, Ismail Haniyeh, a political leader of Hamas, was assassinated, along with his personal bodyguard in the Iranian capital, Tehran. The assassination was a major offense against the sovereignty of the Islamic Republic of Iran. But, you know, they say they elect a moderate, and the first thing that happens is an assassination in Tehran. People are not pleased with the moderation here. The supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khomeini, and the leadership of, I think that should be actually Khomeini, I think that might be misspelled, and the leadership of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRCG, wanted to retaliate for that strike in Tehran. But the president, the moderate, continued his moderate course. On September 23rd, he went to the UN General Assembly in New York, and he put out feelers toward a new accommodation with the U.S. over Iran's nuclear program. This is where it kind of gets really interesting. 4 days afterwards, Israeli airstrikes killed Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah and a major architect of the Iran-led Axis of Resistance, and several other Hezbollah leaders were killed. The assassination of Nasrallah demonstrated that the new president's politics of moderation had failed. And now Iran's plans for retaliating against Israel, they've retaliated, and that retaliation last night required coordination with its allies. On Monday, September 30th, Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishutin happened to be in Tehran, and Israel's Iron Dome missile defense was unable to intercept a significant number of Iran's missiles. A massive Iranian ballistic missile strike on targets in Israel, launched on October 1st, meaning last night, targeted Nevatim Air Force Base. This is in Israel, among other key targets in the country. That facility hosts both the Israeli Air Force's F-35 fifth-generation fighter squadrons, and Iranian media sources have reported that the facility was completely destroyed in the attack. Remarkably, there are no reports of civilian casualties, although I saw a civilian casualty myself last night, where the section of a missile housing fell, landed on a guy, killed him. Tragic. But the significance of the attack on the airfield is that if that's right, they took out the F-35s, the invasion in Lebanon is now going to be bad because they don't have air cover.
So here's what's interesting. The Russians have gotten them to stand down before, so have been part of this moderation. And the Russians at the UN came out against the Pact for the Future, which was passed by what I would consider to be ridiculous and surreptitious means, of course, the U.S. pushing it. It was Russia. Iran was one of the five countries that supported them. And the issue stated was interference with sovereignty of countries.
Yeah.
So for Russia to, essentially allow this, because it is a proxy war, sends a real signal. And to me, one of the signals is the U.S. and Israel can't stop the hypersonic missiles. So this is not just about
That's
Israel.
The signal.
This is about the U.S. and what's going on in Ukraine. And the Russians have done, from 2014 on, they were working to do this. And when Putin, I think it was 2018, when he announced the hypersonic missiles, he tried to make clear in the media, we can stop you. You can't. We have missiles. You can't stop.
I think that was 2017. But
was 2017 right?
Yeah.
But he's been trying to send a message. You can't stop these hypersonic missiles. And I think part of the message here is to the United States, you can't stop these missiles.
Right. On that note, about the Iranian ballistic missile strike, let's go to a map and take a look at. Just again, this is a broader map than the last one. So you've got Israel here, okay? And Iran is over here. Tehran is right here. right? This is not like Lebanon where it's 130 miles away. Tel Aviv is 985 miles from Tehran. Tehran's right here, just south of the Caspian Sea, not on the sea. But let's go to a video. This is Netanyahu last night running to his bunker during the strike. There's no sound in this video. Just him running. He's not kidding around. That it's a serious strike. He's taking cover. And if you doubt me about the missiles, let's take a look at this video. This is a short clip of the missiles raining down hypersonics. Let me lower the volume. Just how fast they're coming down. Look at that.
So there's one discrepancy in reports. Some saying 200, some saying 500.
Yes. Right. And the TASS, the Russian news agency, says 500. New York Times says 200. There were hundreds. And right. Hundreds got through.
Right.
You just saw them coming through. They're raining down. You can't stop them. They're going too fast.
So I watched Netanyahu at a press conference after the attack. And his hands are shaking, but he's saying very few got through because the Americans and Israeli defenses stopped them.
Even if you credit the New York Times, the U.S. launched a maximum of 12 anti-missile interceptors.
Right.
Guess what? The U.S. aircraft carriers weren't around at this time. They had other, but they didn't have aircraft carriers. They had other carriers, right. Like missile right. carriers, but not aircraft carriers. They're gone. Where are they? So to say that all those missiles were intercepted, okay. You know, Israel lies about everything. I didn't know that the Iron Dome interception system, I didn't know that the dome was the surface of the earth. And by that token, I guess, you know, Mossad headquarters and the Israeli airfield intercepted some of those missiles too.
So here's what I don't understand. I do not understand what the U.S. and Israeli strategy is.
I don't think they have one. I think that Israel was so drunk on success when they killed Nasrallah. They've been looking for that guy for 20 years, and they killed him. They got him. And they killed a bunch of other people too with that strike on Beirut. I think it was a simple matter of Israel's just high on its own success. They did what high people do, which is stupid things.
So I think one of the reasons for the slow response and the moderate response is Moscow understands their war is not with the Ukraine, or their war is not with, you know, many of the proxies. Their war is with NATO. And it's an all-global war.
There is no question
right.
that war in Ukraine is between Russia on the one hand and all of NATO on the other hand. I wonder how many U.S. generals do you think have died in the Ukraine, but they've been blamed on things like, oh, they died suddenly in the U.S.
So we just saw a new head of Japan come in, who is a big supporter of moving, extending NATO into Asia.
Yeah. That's incredible.
I don't see the winning plan yet, but
then again, you know, you have these in sports, you have the Atlantic Coast Conference, which now includes teams on the West Coast. Yeah. So everything NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Yeah. Why not have Japan come in? Incredible.
Okay, well, the Russians have clearly made a clear statement about the military state of play.
Yeah, so the question now for Israel is what's the response going to be? How involved is the U.S. going to be in the response, if at all, and when is it going to happen? And I don't know the answer, though. I woke up first thing this morning, go right to the headlines, like, what has Israel done overnight? And the answer this morning, as of October 2nd, is nothing so far.
So my take on all of this is that the U.S. leadership has, and the G7 leadership has, dramatically more reasons to want to have plans in place to extract subsidy from their domestic populations.
Would appear so.
Right.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Right.
But let's turn to Ukraine real quick. The last story before we move on to Hey Robot. Last story on global affairs. You know, you had said, you have warned subscribers before, like, don't think you're going to be safe over here in the U.S. now, given what's happened.
I think part of the message of what happened in Tel Aviv is, you know, we can drop these over North America.
Oh, yeah. Right. No doubt about that.
Right.
You're joined in that by a renowned writer, Gilbert Doctorow, by the way, who put out a statement, an article in response to Russia's revised nuclear doctrine and the latest speech by Vladimir Putin, which we covered last week. It's of highest importance since it concerns a very detailed restatement of Russian thinking about deterrence that followed from the U.S. and British plans to give Kiev unlimited use of their long-range missiles to strike into the heart of Russia. Putin told journalist Zarubin on the sidelines of the St. Petersburg Cultural Forum that Russia will consider the use of British, American, or other long-range missiles against its territory as changing the nature of the present proxy war into a direct Russia-NATO war and will respond appropriately. What does that mean? Doctorow says Russia now declares that any attack on its territory by a non-nuclear state using missiles and other long-range weapons such as the F-16, provided by and guided by a nuclear state, meaning the U.S., Britain, or France, will be considered as a joint attack by the nuclear and non-nuclear state and may prompt Russia a nuclear attack on both the nuclear and non-nuclear state. That means the U.S. That's what that means right there. So I'm with you, Catherine Osifitz. I think you're exactly right about that. You're not safe here in the U.S. With this band of maniacs right in Washington, D.C., you're at risk. Your hide's on the line now.
Right. And here's the thing. We've got to, if the leadership pushes for more subsidy abroad, we either get assassinations here or covert operations or missiles on our head. Their alternative is to extract, to lessen the subsidy they're providing to the domestic population. So, yes. So pick your medicine. You know, do you want to deal with the economic strife or the, you know, weather warfare or, you know, whatever is going on in Western California? Or do you want to deal with assassinations and missiles on your heads? Either way, there's a price to pay for living off of subsidy extracted from other people, as opposed to being, you know, growing more food than you eat. Okay.
Right.
We've got to get back to productivity and we've got to wean ourselves from our dependency on extracting it globally. That's our reality. So
it is. Yes. Very well put.
Turn the red button green.
Before I forget, I need to also say, I should have said this at the top, but I'll forget it if I don't say it now. We're publishing this on October 3rd. It's the 16th anniversary of TARP's passage in the U.S., the bailout passage back in the financial crisis 2008. A dark day for America.
You got to give them credit. They've kept it going for another 16 years.
They have.
Right. Yep. Not easy to do.
The bailouts have never stopped. That balance sheet it went up and it never came back down.
Right.
You know. Okay, let's move on to Hey Robot. We're gonna scan a series of headlines here, all involving major US companies, all involving basically the control grid. From Ars Technica, omnipresent AI cameras will ensure good behavior, says Larry Ellison, like the Panopticon. Ellison, of course, is the Oracle co-founder. So don't worry, AI is good. AI cameras everywhere are good. From the Defender, we should absolutely be worried. Google is testing a new digital ID for Google Wallet. Right. That's first Google story. Also, from the Intercept, Google was set to host an Israeli military conference, but when we asked about it, the event just disappeared. And finally, Microsoft CEO for Israel to appear at an event celebrating Israeli military AI. So these headlines, you know, all these big companies in the U.S., they're all these massive companies all run by billionaires. It's all about the control grid.
Right.
Right. Okay. That takes us to the next story, which is really a video from a speech that you turned me on to this. I'm going to run it. It's a little bit long, about 2.5 minutes. Netanyahu. So this week, we always have a Daily Double on Soleri, a story or a writer or a publication. This week, it's Netanyahu for our Daily Double. And here's his speech. Listen to this speech. It sounds like John Lennon's Imagine, and he even says that's pretty much what it is. Here we go. Let's watch this. Listen to what he says.
Imagine personalized education that cultivates each person's full potential throughout their lifetime. Imagine a world with boundless clean energy and natural resources for all nations. Imagine precision agriculture and automated factories that yield food and goods in an abundance that ends hunger and want. I know this sounds like a John Lennon song, but it could all happen. Imagine that we could achieve the end of scarcity, something that eluded humanity for all history. It's all within our reach. And here's something else within our reach. With AI, we can explore the heavens as never before and extend humanity beyond our blue planet. For good or bad, the developments of AI will be spearheaded by a handful of nations, and my country, Israel, is already among them. Just as Israel's technological revolution provided the world with breathtaking innovations, I'm confident that AI developed by Israel will once again help all humanity. I call upon world leaders to come together to shape the great changes before us, but to do so in a responsible and ethical way. Our goal must be to ensure that AI brings more freedom and not less, prevents wars instead of starting them, and ensures that people live longer, healthier, more productive, and peaceful lives. It's within our reach. And as we harness the powers of AI, let us always remember the irreplaceable value of human intuition and wisdom. Let us cherish and preserve the human capacity for empathy, which no machine could replace.
Unbelievable.
So, you know, I've always believed, and this is conjecture, but I've always believed that one of the reasons that this group was so adamant that they needed the water, the land, the oil and gas, you know, and to basically move the Palestinians out, you know, their preference to Egypt, but if not eradicate, was they wanted to build a critical aspect of the control grid. And what's interesting about this is the presentation is, you give us complete control. Here's my interpretation of what Netanyahu said, and I'm guessing. You give this group of people complete control of the financial and food system, and they will be able to then, you know, launch breakthrough energy because you've got the control to do it, and will create heaven on earth, this sort of utopia, which is ridiculous because you're basically talking about no individual or national sovereignty. Talking about the complete end of sovereignty. And for some reason, the people who are going to be in control of it think it's going to be wonderful for you.
Yeah. Well, let me summarize the speech this way. I would summarize it a different way. I would say, you know what? Rather than have wars, why don't we just have a system of global slavery? Would that be better?
Right. Right.
Yeah. You don't need wars. We just make slaves out of everybody.
If you look at the vision he's promoting here or in the 2035 sort of picture of the new Gaza versus, you know, what is happening right now on the ground to create that, you know, to clean the space for that vision. I've never seen the demonstration of an official narrative further from the reality. On the ground,
he's disconnected. He's no longer right. with us.
It's complete disassociation.
Yeah, total.
Right.
The cognitive dissonance in that speech is off the charts.
Right. Do you think that the Russians finally clearing the Iranians to drop that many missiles on Tel Aviv related to watching this speech?
No.
No?
The Russians, I don't think that speech influenced them one way or the other.
Okay.
Because I don't, Netanyahu is like all other leaders in the world. They could snap him like a twig, throw him out, you know,
right.
with yesterday's garbage.
Right.
That speech had nothing to do with it.
Okay.
I don't think, I mean, anyway.
Well, let's see. Okay.
Yeah. We should say, anyway, let's go to some charts. S&P versus Microsoft. This is year to date. Microsoft not doing not doing bad.
Microsoft, it's interesting because OpenAI is now trying to convert to a for-profit. Microsoft's the lead investor, and they're having to do a new round of funding. It's one of the reasons I wanted to look at Microsoft in Israel and with OpenAI. Because yeah. OpenAI seems to be, and converting to a for-profit seems to be part of whatever the infrastructure in Israel is doing around AI. And anyway, so I wanted to look at Microsoft versus S&P. Apple has dropped from the OpenAI funding, which is kind of interesting. But you know, the folks who get around AI are getting very excited about how much money they can make. Interestingly enough, you've seen 30 executives, John, drop from OpenAI. We just saw three leave it, you know, now. And their opportunities to make money are fantastic. And yet the change from being a not-for-profit, doing a social good, to a for-profit, trying to make money for whoever the investors and the executives are, has caused 30 to walk out the door. So we are watching the advent of a new technology, and the culture and the governance is not in place to handle it.
Why do you think people are walking away from AI? Those people?
I think you have three executives who are walking away from the conversion of OpenAI from a not-for-profit defined as for the public good to a for-profit entity that is much more about making money for its investors and has a very different governance mission and goal. So you've got executives saying, I don't want to be a part of this, I'm out.
Okay, and have they been replaced?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. They've just, the last three just resigned.
So interesting. I haven't tracked that story.
You what?
I have not tracked that story.
Right. No, I know you haven't tracked
leaving.
It.
Yeah.
Right. But what I'm seeing between Netanyahu's speech and what's going on in the software world and the AI world is you literally don't have a governance structure in place or a culture that is able to properly handle this technology. And part of the Pact of the Future was some glorious statement about how it was all going to be governed. But, you know, the governance structure is not in place to handle this properly. And that's going to make a lot of interesting action. And Israel is right at the heart of the story.
Right. And those companies like Larry Ellison saying, yeah, the Panopticon is good in your best behavior.
Right.
And then you've got Bill Gates' company, Microsoft. I mean, it's like the all-star lineup from hell.
It's an all-star lineup of people who think they're going to become wildly powerful by controlling everybody else and using this technology to do it. And they need lots of land, lots of water, and lots of energy. So we just saw Bill Gates announce that he wants to use AI to make sure that misinformation doesn't spread in the world or on the internet about vaccines. So he wants to use AI to continue to poison global citizens and Americans. Yeah. And Pennsylvania just announced, so he just announced, and Constellation Energy just announced that they're going to unmothball the Three Mile Island nuclear station to provide energy for the data centers that will help Bill Gates do this.
Oh, you got to be kidding me.
No, no. So we are unmothballing Three Mile Island, one of the locations of one of the most famous nuclear meltdowns in the world. We're going to unmothball it. So the second station has been mothballed for 5 years to provide energy for Microsoft data centers.
Wow.
Meantime, Bill Gates is announcing he's going to use AI to make sure we can suppress honest information about vaccines.
Yeah, Bill Gates and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and Kamala Harris and professors at law schools.
So these guys are grabbing this technology, whether it's Netanyahu or Bill Gates or all the, we'll dive in and we'll look at the charts, but this is about fueling the control grid.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
Right.
It's because it's an energy eating monster. Okay, let's go to both Bitcoin and AI gobbling up your energy. You're going to freeze to death while people can pay Bitcoin for their artificial intelligence. Unbelievable. Right. But let's go to these AI charts. Leading countries by research by R&D is the share of GDP. Look who's number one.
Israel.
Yep. And U.S. is batting clean up there at fourth.
Right. Now, remember, Israel's a much smaller GDP. So,
yeah.
Right. So this is percent of GDP. But, you know, Netanyahu and Israel have been absolutely clear for decades that they want to be the leader in IT. You know, they want to be Silicon Valley in the Middle East, and they want to be a leader in all of this.
Here they go. Okay, let's go to the next chart. A global AI index ranking of Israel in 2023 by Indicator Group. Government strategy 47. Anything to add?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Leading academic institutes for AI research from January 10, 2010 to June 2024 by publication count. These are interesting.
Right.
Names of institutes. Technion, Tel Aviv, Hebrew.
Right.
Wow. That's incredible.
So they've poured huge talent into this. There's no doubt about it. So, but they've been very clear about this for years.
Yeah, I don't see just Israel. I mean, I don't see a single university outside of Israel.
Right. When I looked at this chart, I was wondering if it was focused on Israel. I wasn't sure.
It has to be. Leading academic for AI research. By publication count. I don't know how they get 50.3. Right.
But look, it's the next one, the sites. Yeah, so if you look at how much the big tech companies in the U.S. have poured into installations and operations in Israel, you know, there's a very, very deep relationship. And it's one of the things that Whitney Webb has explored in her work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, and I remember during the Clinton administration.
It's kind of a goofy chart. It's like two or one.
Right.
But they're into it, though.
Yeah, definitely into it.
Those are huge facilities, no doubt about that.
Right. And one of the things that happened, I will never forget it, during the Clinton administration, is there was a lot of sort of discussion in Washington about the power of the Mossad surveillance and Israeli intelligence in the United States. Some of it because of the close relationship between NSA, the British, and Israel. So, but they were a huge player in IT, and it was growing then.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, yeah, the war for AI and for digital control is on. There's no doubt.
It's absolutely on.
Yeah.
And what everyone here can do is make sure, you know, your state legislators and your local leaders and your bankers understand what is coming and the fact that we have the power to do something about it and stop it. But if we don't, we literally are going to a global slavery system.
Right. That's clear. And you think about the pressures that are coming to bear on this. you've got basically all Silicon Valley is behind this. They don't care about the Constitution. Okay. Israel was one of the best U.S. allies. They're all on board for complete digital control. You've got also legal law professors, you know, in attacking the Constitution and saying, oh, it's a dead letter and we're slaves of the Constitution and free speech is in the way. It's coming all around. It's all sides. There's no accident.
Right. But you know what the most important signal, I think, and it's one you found and showed on Money and Markets, is when Peter Thiel was asked the question by a Cambridge student what he thought about his contribution to the control grid on Lavender in Israel.
Yeah.
He came apart at the seams.
He did.
He did.
Was absolutely incoherent. But Peter Thiel is often incoherent. He looks like he's on coke every time I see him. This guy can't get a sentence out. Unbelievable.
Right. But here's the thing. You know, you're seeing a tsunami of money pouring into this and people involved. But again, they don't have a governance structure to organize and protect it and handle it properly. And Peter Thiel's demonstration was a complete proof of that.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that is our opportunity. The control grid is out of control.
Completely. Remember, Peter Thiel's the guy who got away with taking out Silicon Valley Bank. He absolutely started that wrong on Silicon Valley Bank.
Right.
Totally got away with it. It's in congressional testimony that he did this. But he was afraid of that. He came apart at the seams over that question, didn't he?
Well, John has told you that the Fed is afraid of transparency, and he's right. And what does that tell us? We bring as much transparency as possible as fast as possible.
Yeah, amp up the transparency.
Absolutely.
Amp up the sunlight. Yeah.
Yep.
Speaking of sunlight. And bringing the pressure, let's turn to Farmageddon. Okay, a story from the New York Post. This is, you had to have known this. This is going on. This is Cuomo. Personally altered report that lowballed COVID nursing home deaths emails show, contradicting his claim to Congress. Former Governor Cuomo personally altered a state review that lowballed the nursing home COVID-19 death count emails detailed in a new report show, a revelation that directly contradicts his claims that he had nothing to do with it. Emails and congressional documents undercut his defiant assertion during a summer congressional grilling that he never saw or even had any memory of State Department health report, the New York Times reported. The governor, quote, governor's edits are attached for your review, end quote, Cuomo's assistant wrote to the then governor's senior staff in June 2020. So he's personally editing them. The Post points out, Cuomo wasn't sworn in under oath when he gave this testimony. I'm here to tell you that doesn't matter. You lie to Congress, and that's a crime,
right?
Under oath or not.
So if you go back to the beginning of the pandemic, to get the measures going and to promote the injection, you needed deaths, and we saw, I believe, engineered deaths in New York and Seattle, and I will bet you anything. If the truth of Harris's communications with Cuomo and the arranging, Cuomo later came out and got in a squabble with Harris because he felt he'd been promised a cabinet position and didn't get it. And you wonder, you know, what cabinet position was he promised in exchange for 20,000 deaths? Reported deaths, I should say.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So right, he's up to his eyeballs.
The death certificates are nowhere to be found, but
right,
yeah,
yeah. So remember, Cuomo is the guy who helped engineer and get a lot of the mortgage fraud going and the missing money going.
Yeah,
right.
He's a repeat player, repeat offender.
Right, he's a repeat offender.
Yeah,
Cuomo has a long history of government mob operations.
He does. You're right. let's keep it going on Farmageddon to the next story. This is interesting from Newsweek. COVID treatment recall issued after glass found in drug. This is a multifunction story. Amidst a resurgence of COVID-19 cases across the U.S., pharmaceutical company Gilead Sciences has announced a voluntary recall of its antiviral drug, basically remdesivir, in cooperation with U.S. Food and Drug Administration, The recall comes after the discovery of glass particles in vials of the medication, raising concerns about patient safety at a time when the drug's importance in treating severe COVID-19 cases is once again being underscored. And I think that's the function of the story is it gets COVID back in the headlines. COVID's scary again. But the introduction of glass, you know, there's been a lot of stories about how the injection, right, the vaccine has injured a lot of people. And you see how it just tears up their insides. Now you got a story that kind of is in the public mix to muddy the waters about what's doing the damage internally to people.
Well, Vax 3 is just about to start streaming. It's already been through the premiere, and it's showing how remdesivir is being used to kill people. Now they can say, oh, well, you know, it was quality control problems. It wasn't intentional euthanasia.
Right. And it's from Newsweek. To me, that just has, when I saw that story, I'm like, oh, here we go. What yarn are you spinning now? So it's a few. It's like those. Don't worry about those deaths. Don't worry about the internal damage that's coming from glass, from that drug. And two, you got to worry about COVID again. You know, at least they're off a bird flu for a week. Give it a rest. I don't know which way they're going to go.
Well, Redfield is out telling everybody that they lied. I don't know if you saw it. He did an interview with Chris Cuomo. He's just explaining how they lied and lied and lied and lied. I was like, what's going on here?
Yeah. They do that a lot. Like after people get out of office, they come clean. They never come clean in office. It's always afterwards.
I don't know. I can't figure out what he's up to, but. It's funny because I've had several allies tell me how happy they were that he did it. And as though, okay, well, things are coming back right. And I don't see that. I don't see things coming back right. The greatest tweet of the week was Toby Rogers. You know, you had this wonderful group of people get together in Washington and talk about how we had to make America healthy again, right?
Yeah.
And he tweets out and he says, you know, changing Fruit Loops doesn't do it. If you're not willing to address the autism epidemic caused by vaccines, you ought to shit down and shut the you-know-what up.
Yeah,
it was pretty funny.
Anyway, let's go to pushback with another recurring character on the story, but this is a good one. This isn't Darth Vader. This is Thomas Massie from Responsible Statecraft. He says, Washington is purposely blacking out Ukraine casualty data. This is an interesting story just because of Massey's access. Earlier this summer, Massey introduced an amendment to the annual defense policy bill, the NDAA, which requires a report on the casualty and equipment losses for both sides in the conflict in Ukraine. His amendment was accepted into the House's version of the NDAA and awaits review by the Senate. So you're supposed to cough up information on both sides' casualties. So he's interviewed here by Responsible Statecraft, the publication that's putting this out. What was your particular motivation for introducing this amendment? He says, Massey, well, in a classified briefing, I stood up and asked what the casualties were on the Ukrainian side in that meeting. He says, I believe you had a representative from the intelligence community, and they were briefing us, and they went out of their way to tell us how many Russian casualties there were, and they would not answer my question of how many Ukrainian casualties they were. And this is a briefing to Congress in a classified setting.
Wow.
They really didn't have an excuse other than they weren't really sure, which seems like an incredible lie. You know how many Ukrainian? So he goes to the Speaker's office, the Speaker of the House, and he says, do you know how many Ukrainian casualties there are? And he said, no. I said, have they ever told you? And he said, no. I said, have you ever asked? He said, I should ask. So the Speaker of the House, the bottom line here, the punchline of this, Thomas Massie is telling us that the Speaker of the House in the House of Representatives in Congress does not know how many Ukrainian casualties there are. This war has been going on for 2.5 years, and yet the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the United States has no idea How many people on the Ukrainian side have died?
The latest headline I read yesterday is more than 50% of the new recruits to the Ukrainian army die within the first 4 days.
Yeah. I saw that. That's terrible. Because right. they're older, so they're not in any kind of physical shape.
Right.
They don't have any training. Things are going, they're just being fed like hamburger into the food process. 4 days. That's just, they're wiping out that country.
Right. I've seen estimates of as many as 1 million dead on the Ukrainian side.
That would surprise me a little bit, but I wouldn't bet any money on it.
Right.
I mean, you just don't know.
A little high. Right.
You don't know.
You just don't know.
The fact that the Speaker of the House of Representatives doesn't know tells you it's awful, really bad.
Well, it tells
how
you
does that not that come
he's,
up?
He's, well, it's telling you, you know, if you don't want to know something, you don't ask the question.
Right.
The Speaker doesn't want to know because right. it creates liability for the Speaker if he knows.
Yeah, I should ask. Yeah.
Right.
Should ask this, 2 years ago.
This is why it makes an enormous difference that Thomas Massie is there.
Yeah.
And this is why, because I've been trying, we're just about to send out an update to, you know, on Denis Kucinich.
Mm.
It would, if you look at everything Denis Kucinich has done to bring transparency to issues like this, and his good relationship with Massie. You know, each person you get in there, or you look at what Ron Johnson has done, each person you get in there who drives transparency makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, Kucinich will really, between he and Massie, they will really drive transparency about the Fed.
That's great. I mean,
right.
I wish Kucinich would win in that race. I don't think he probably will, but I don't know. I mean,
you know something? I'm going to do everything I can to help him. We're sending out an update. And we're saying, you know, wherever you are in the world, he can help you with freedom. So pray for him. You know, if you're in the U.S., you can donate. If you're in Ohio 7th, you can work on the campaign and vote. I mean, there's no excuse for anybody who loves freedom to not make this one happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. I did not know what you just told me, that Kucinich was kind of allied with Thomas Massie. Kucinich is a Democrat from Ohio, and Massie's a Republican from Kentucky, no?
Well, Denis is running as an independent. He's an ex-Democrat.
Okay. Historically, right. He's a Democrat.
Right.
And Massie's a Republican. And they,
right.
I didn't know that. I'll tell you something else about Kucinich. That guy, out of all the representatives over the last 10, 20 years, knows more about how the monetary system works yep. than anybody else.
Yep.
And I think that's probably why he's, what happened is my understanding is that the congressional districts there were gerrymandered in a way following the global financial crisis that basically forced out either Kucinich or Marcy Kaptur.
Right.
Okay. That one of them was a casualty. I think it was Kucinich, which doesn't surprise me because as much of a menace as Marcy Kaptur was to the powers that be, she voted against TARP twice, for right. example. Kucinich was worse because he knew more about how the system worked.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And our next story is from a dear friend of Thomas Massie.
Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, the story is from Adam Taggart, but it's really, Taggart is interviewing this guy, Joel Salatin.
Right.
Yeah. Farmers fix this. So Salatin is talking about, he's, let me punch in a little bit on this story so I can, here we go. Named the most famous farmer in America, Joel spent his career advocating for sustainable farming practices and pioneering models that show how food can be grown in ways that are regenerative to our topsoils. So a big ag doesn't like that. Are more humane to livestock. They don't like that. Produce healthier food. They don't like that. And contribute profitably to the local economy. Can't have that. Who wouldn't want that? Well, let me tell you who wouldn't want it.
Farm Bureau doesn't want it.
ConAgra, any of the big ones.
Yep.
But Joel finds He has to refer to himself as the lunatic farmer because so many of the changes he thinks our food system needs are either illegal under current law or mightily resisted by the deep pockets controlling production and distribution. So Taggart Scott, you can see it here. I'm not going to play it. But he's got this interview on YouTube of Joel Salatin.
You know, it's one of the great opportunities. If we can convert to regenerative farming, we can rebuild the soil. We can stop poisoning kids. And we can create lots of jobs and a strong economy.
Yeah.
And on one thing, I do agree with Netanyahu, precision agriculture. There is a lot that automation can do to support really economic regenerative farming. There is a real opportunity. So.
Wow. Catherine Austin Fitz and Netanyahu agreeing. I'm shocked.
Okay. Remember, a broken clock is right twice a day.
Yeah. Right. You got it. Okay. Let's go to the remainder of the charts we have this week. Starting with FXI versus S&P and VGK. Look at that.
So wait a minute. Let me expand this. Yeah.
This is
we talked about the subsidy and we're watching the Chinese stock market take off like a rocket.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same trajectory as the hypersonic missiles just going up.
Yeah.
Anyway, right. But that's remarkable because the Chinese market has really been, you know, in the doghouse vis-a-vis the U.S. and the European market. But here we go.
Especially since it's the pandemic.
Right.
You know, when the Fed came in and really goosed things by buying $5 trillion right. of assets from non-banks, that really pumped up the.
So throughout going direct reset, China's looked, you know, in the doghouse, but now yep. it's but the now, subsidies turning it.
And we said it was a little bit over $100 billion into the Chinese stock market. But to put that in perspective, you remember when there was a kind of a drain, of sort of a run on U.S. money markets back in 2008?
Mm-hmm.
The way that was stopped was the Treasury stepped in basically to the Exchange Stabilization Fund and said, we're backstopping money market funds to the tune of $50 billion.
Right.
$50 billion. Okay. China's putting in over $100 billion, and it's not a backstop. It's an injection.
Right.
That's a huge amount of money, and you're seeing it in this chart. That's a lot right. of scratch that's doing that. That's a big increase. Look at that. It went from basically 10% up to over 40% up in short order. That's an amazing chart.
Imagine how much you could make if you knew they were about to do it.
Yeah, I don't torture myself. It'd be a lot though, you're right. Okay. Safety trade, what do we got?
Well, you know, one of the things that's driving the some of the markets up is gold and silver are having a very strong year. So I wanted to look at them vis-a-vis the S&P. So this is year to date, silver up 32%. Now this is the ETF. Gold up 20, essentially right. 27-28%. S&P up 20, and then the miners are dragging. I would have expected them to do better, but selective miners are doing very, very well. It depends on which ones you're in and which part of the market you're in. But anyway, there's no doubt that the investment, gold and silver attractive as a core position, but clearly now attractive as an investment position. I want to remind everybody, if you look at the inflationary trends, you would expect this to continue unless you get a serious war scenario. And the reality is you can watch gold and silver deflate like a balloon in a serious war scenario. So just be prepared if what happens in the Ukraine and the Middle East go, you know, accelerate dramatically, you could see gold and silver really fall out of bed.
Yeah, that's a fact. That's a good reminder.
Right.
It's counterintuitive too. You think, well, you know, uncertainty right. war that would go. It doesn't work that way.
Doesn't work that way at all.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. Okay, let's go back to charts and turn to 30-year Treasury to date.
Right. So this is the 30-year Treasury yield, and I just wanted to show you how the market reacted to the Fed drop. So the Fed funds rate as market rates are going down from the beginning of the year on. I'm just trying to see.
Yeah, well, the rate cut down. Is here.
Right. So the rate
it's
cut.
Not, it's not that big
Fed
a
funds was at 5.25 to 5.50. And then they cut it 50 basis points, which was a big cut. But they're basically chasing the market down, and then the market started to turn up again. But it's, if you look at the market yield, it's at 4.08, and the Fed funds rate is now sitting at 4.75 to 5, which right. is significantly higher than the market rate.
Hmm.
So it's, you know, it's way up above the peak.
So
the Fed chasing the market.
What's the Fed going to be doing in response to all the missiles flying around?
You know, that's a good question. And the Fed is going to make sure that everybody they want to have liquidity has liquidity. Question is, how do they do that? But
that is a good question.
Right. I mean,
I suspect we'll have more than an inkling next week.
Here's the problem if you're the Fed, and it's exactly what you described. If you need to move to the control grid, if you need to move to control and you need authorizing legislation and you want to achieve less transparency, how do you do it? And I would say that if you look at what's going on in the Middle East and if you look at what's going on globally, you know, you want the pact for the future. You want the, you know, the Japanese to play ball on NATO. You want NATO to win. But if you look at what's going on in the Ukraine and the Middle East and what your allies are up to, as well as big tech, you know, everybody that you need to operationalize the control grid is making a mess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about it. Imagine you woke up tomorrow and you're Jerome Powell and you have to implement, you know, you have to get from here to there. And you're watching Larry Ellison, Peter Thiel, Bill Gates, Netanyahu making a mess hither and yon.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were Jerome Powell, would you sleep at night?
No, but I think you're exactly right, though. The way you fight transparency is, I mean, emergencies, panic, war, perfect. Right? Because you can get away, if it's an emergency, we can suspend that constitution. Yeah. It's pesky.
I don't know. I think increasingly you have to feel like the people you're depending on to operationalize this are very much letting you down.
Yeah, right.
I would be extremely nervous.
I would be too.
I would be. So.
Yeah, not with this crew. Okay. Anyway, we'll see. We'll see next week. We'll have a good idea what the Fed's going to do. Next week,
right, I go back to our theme, cash in the Constitution. We have powerful weapons. We have a huge opportunity to use them. You know, get out there and bring transparency. You know, get every banker you know, every government official you know, understanding the train that's coming at us, and dial back that digital system. Just dial it back. If everybody did it, it would be just if you and 10 friends and family you know will do that. This, it could start a revolution. I mean, the message from North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee is you better have cash.
Yeah, right. You better start preparing. Yep.
Right. Okay, John.
Let's go.
Oh, we got more? We have to do Solari. Let's go.
We've got Solari in-house. Come on. It's your company.
So we finally collected all of our different selections of short videos. We call them shorties. And you can access them. We have a little panel at the top of the homepage. It's just shorties, and you have all the lists. So financial transaction freedom, the fight for food freedom, understanding the risks and more. Case for building wealth, energy, and take action. So if you're trying to bring transparency, that financial transaction freedom list, there's nothing better. So we recommend these.
I've watched a lot of the ones in here. They're really good. So check them out. Okay.
Yeah.
Next up, coming to health sovereignty.
So our interview, we've published it. It's already published. It's up. Health sovereignty, avoiding emergency rooms if you can, staying in charge if you can, with Dr. Sam Bailey. This is a really good one. And Jennifer Walters provided a lot of checklists and other materials. So staying out of hospitals if you can do it can be a lifesaver and certainly a money saver. So.
Yeah, that's what I would say. Avoiding, John Titus says, avoid hospitals.
Right.
Not enough to avoid emergency rooms. You got to stay out of the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to do hospitals too. We're getting there. Okay.
Omnivore Symposium.
We, a fabulous symposium led by Patrick Wood with David Hughes and Lissa Johnson and Daniel Brody. And this really, David and Lissa did an incredible job of reviewing all the military intelligence money pouring into the control grid and what they call bio-nanotechnology. And I can't recommend it enough, particularly David and Lissa's presentations go into all the high-tech stuff being used to sort of, and if you want to understand why some of your neighbors are behaving like zombies, David and Lissa can explain it to you. So I strongly recommend, strongly recommend those two.
Okay.
Anyway, it's up at Solarian the News or up at Technocracy News.
All right. And next up, Land Grab with Carolyn Betts.
Yeah, so we were asked by one of the legislators in Tennessee to grapple with how they passed legislation to protect against a land grab. And one of the things we realized is to do that kind of analysis, we really need to look at what the different tactics are that are used to sort of grab land. And so we wrote a piece that we published last week. It's called Plunder Capitalism, Land Grab. And then Carolyn and I discussed it in our interview. So that was last week.
That was last week. Okay. And now we have action of the week.
Yeah. So bring transparency, make a push for financial freedom in 5 minutes. So what I do, I have an elevator pitch for legislators with 3 1-minute videos, including the one that John clipped out of Augustine Carson's in 2020. You have personally made Augustine Carson's famous, John, with that clip.
Thank you. I also did the Bo Lee clip.
Yeah, you did the Bo Lee clip. Yeah. But the Bo Lee clip, as chilling as it is just not as famous and powerful on a viral basis as your Augustine Carson.
Carson stole the show with that symposium.
He did, in October
2020. He just went nuts. Yeah. Oh, the control we have.
If you take these 3 1-minute videos and you just show it to anyone, your bankers, your friends, if you have any government leaders, they really don't know. And they see these 3 1-minute videos and they're like,
and Cash Carry is in there too, you found. And Cash Carry, to remind subscribers, he's the guy who was Paulson's guy, Paulson's right hand man,
right,
during the financial crisis. He's the one who came up with $700 billion as the bailout because it was 5% of the then GDP. He then goes into the mountains of California, according to these stories, and then comes back out and he's ta-da, he's the Minneapolis Federal Reserve president, which is where he remains to this day. But even he says, "Oh, why do we need?" Why do we need CBDC? I could use Venmo.
Well, he explains you can do it because it gives you complete surveillance, and you can charge negative interest rates, and you can take taxes directly out of customer accounts, right?
Yeah.
So the central bankers can run the taxation system without Congress and without the executive branch, and ultimately without the Supreme Court, right?
Right. Yep.
Right. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So,
And batting cleanup is who really owns U.S. housing market.
Corey Lynn has done a great report on the U.S. housing market that's very interesting. 40% of Americans now own their home outright, no mortgage. Or it's 40% of the homeowners. But the other thing she discovered was that the mom and pops, 1 to 9 homes, are a bigger part of the market than the big investors. Now, I think that's going to change, but and if you look at sort of the hurricane areas, I think one of the messages the mom and pops are being encouraged to sell. But it turned out to be a much more optimistic and hopeful story than I'd expected. It wouldn't surprise me because what I've seen in our subscribers and my former clients as an investment advisor is a lot of people moving money out of the brokerage system and into local real estate. So in one sense, it doesn't surprise me. But it's a very deep and interesting overlook at the U.S. housing market.
Interesting. But I will remind people, you don't own anything without the rule of law. Bank of America, to remind subscribers, foreclosed on a man who did not have a mortgage. He paid cash for his house, lost it anyway in court. So
you're right. No rule of law. You got nothing.
You got to keep the pressure on.
Right. That's cash and the Constitution.
You know, Benjamin Franklin said, "Is you know, the Constitution is great if you can keep it." And that's right. what he's getting at is, you got to keep that pressure on. That right. pressure is what pumps that sunlight into that system.
Just understand, it's a huge opportunity.
Yeah,
we can do it. Okay, yep. John, I will talk to you next week. I get a feeling it's going to be as action packed.
The tough week to top for that is too much. That should have been a theme. Too much action.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, have a great week. And John and I will talk to you next week. Thank you for joining us on Money and Markets at the Solaria Report.